Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
This is Mitchell Davis, host of Taste Matters. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Wiley Dufresne. And we're sitting not in Roberta's in the back, but at the International Culinary Center, which Wiley did not graduate from. He graduated from the French Culinary Institute, but we've since evolved because of all of our international programming into the International Culinary Center. But I was here when he was here. But Wiley Dufresne, for those few who do not know him out there, is probably one of the most celebrated chefs in New York City. But just recently, there was this secret party of the decade, if not century, where some of the top chefs from all over the world flew in to give him a birthday party. And boy, did that go crazy all over the media wires on how much all your colleagues and fellow chefs adore you and love you and came in for this party. But we'll talk about that a bit later. So why did they do that? Well, I think Wiley is probably one of the most intellectual and intellectually probing chefs today, doing interesting food that not only appeals to the public, but really inspires and intrigues fellow chefs and professionals. And we're really looking forward to talking to him a bit about getting behind the scenes on that. And as I said, Wiley, he actually grew up in, I think, Providence, Rhode Island, and he went to Colbert College to study philosophy and came here, but then he went to work for Jean Georges, and he went out to Las Vegas, to the Bellagio, and came back and opened his own place, WD50, but first he was at Clinton Fresh Food on the same block and started really his personal cuisine then. Recently he opened Alder, which is a more casual place, and he's done this on the back of being named back in 2001 one of Food & Wine's best 10 chefs. He's gotten 3 stars from Frank Bruni in the New York Times. In 2013, he won the James Beard Award Best Chef New York City. He's been on lots of TV shows, and I welcome you. Wiley, thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, as always, back at the alma mater, if you will.
So was it Rhode Island you grew up, or were you just born in Rhode Island?
I was born in Rhode Island. I moved to New York City when I was about 6 years old.
So you're a New York City kid.
I am. I am indeed.
Which schools did you go to in New York City?
I went to Friends Seminary for the rest of my middle and high school career.
Did you like middle and high school?
I did. I like New York very much. I mean, I'm still here. I'm raising my family here. I have nothing but love for New York. Yeah, absolutely.
So what were your favorite subjects when you were in school?
I mean, back then, as a little kid?
Middle school. Let's go.
Middle school. I don't know if I can remember. You know, I think mostly probably like all kids, running around, causing trouble, playing sports.
What sports?
I played softball, basketball, and soccer. Actually in the order of soccer, basketball, and softball. But seasonally. The 3 seasons that school's in session. But I enjoyed playing sports a lot. I enjoyed running around.
What was New York like then?
I think New York was different. I grew up initially in Greenwich Village and then Union Square. And I think both of those neighborhoods have changed dramatically. I'd say particularly Union Square, because maybe I spent more time there and ultimately moved there after after college as well. And got to see, you know, have spent a long, long time in Union Square and seen it change and evolve.
So the almost the gentrification, because was it, were the farmers markets there when you first went to Union Square?
You know, I don't know exactly when the farmers market started, but I used to walk through Union Square every day on my way to school. So I don't specifically remember when that began, and probably as a, you know, 12, 13, 14 year old, I would have just seen it as something to walk through and not necessarily stop and admire. As I began to, you know, once I started my culinary career. But
so where would you like to stop and get something to eat after school?
You know, I have fond memories of Jefferson Market, which used to be over on 6th Avenue. I mean, it's still to a certain extent over on 6th Avenue. It used to be on the other side of the street, and it used to be a much larger footprint. But I, you know, my mom would send me to school. I was a latchkey kid, a very sort of classic New York City latchkey kid, and my mom would send me to school with money and instructions to either go buy a roast chicken or go buy a meatloaf or go buy, you know, 5 pounds.
Already made?
Yeah, go buy a prepared meatloaf or go buy a prepared roast chicken or go buy, 5 pounds of raw ground beef and bring it home, and then that would somehow become dinner. At the time. I mean, my parents were divorced a long time ago, and I would spend half of my year with my mother, who lived at that time in Greenwich Village, and the other half of the year with my father, who ultimately lived in Hoboken for most of my childhood. So I would split my time, and then if I went to Hoboken, I would, you know, there were local bakeries where I could go and on my way home and grab a fresh loaf of bread with, you know, prosciutto baked into the bread. And
so
I
there were Italian bakeries?
In Hoboken, yeah, there, and there still are, you know.
Did you have to go to school from Hoboken to New York?
I did, but it was very easy. I mean, take the path across 14th Street and take the bus from 14th and 6th to 14th and 3rd and then walk.
Yeah.
Two blocks to Friends Seminary. Right. So that was a very easy commute, you know, back when kids had bus passes and stuff before that.
So studying philosophy is not something a lot of people choose. How did you choose to study philosophy?
Well, you know, I graduated high school. Probably some of my best subjects were things like English, the non-mathematical studies, sciences, were where I did better. And I didn't want to go to college to be an English major because I was just felt like sort of an extension of what I had focused a little bit on in high school. And so I had long had an interest in Eastern philosophies, Japan, China.
Really? How did that get started?
I'm not really sure, but I was interested at a young age in the Japanese aesthetic, the Japanese sort of lifestyle, the simplicity, the focus, the discipline, the dedication, and I started looking into those, you know, Shinto, Taoism, Buddhism, all of that, and then began to sort of branch out to the Far East, and in hindsight, I probably would have ended up. I was very close to being either a religion major or a philosophy major.
So Friends was a Quaker school.
Yep.
Did that have a lot of influence on you?
I think that the mentality of Friends has always had an influence on me. It was a very nice place. It was a very friendly place. It was a very supportive place. It was a place that encouraged you to be yourself and encouraged you to find yourself. And I think that was something that's always stuck with me. That there's a kindness to Friends, but there's also an understanding to Friends and embracing you for who you are and what you are. That I think, I hope I've carried on that spirit.
So that's really interesting because it sounds like they opened your mind to take on the bigger question, you know, who am I and how to be who I am, you know? And then philosophy is questioning life in the macrocosm. And you know, I find your cuisine very questioning of, you know, looking at something and saying, what really is it and why do we perceive it one way? But we'll get into that later. But it's very interesting, this probing thing.
I've always been a curious person, and I attribute that more to my parents, and they're encouraging me to ask questions and be curious.
Yeah, what did your parents do?
But I think again, it's interesting because philosophy in the West is more just sort of, like you say, thinking, metaphysical, whereas philosophy in the East is more about just how to live, how to be, and it becomes intertwined, the religion and the philosophy. It's more about just, there's no differentiation in the East. Like, your religion is your philosophy. Your philosophy is your religion. It's basically how to live your life, whereas in the East, it's more about, I mean, in the West, it's more about people who have the luxury of thinking about their metaphysical place in the world and stuff like that. But I attribute a lot of my thought process, as I said, to my parents.
So what did they do?
My parents have done a number of different things. My father's been in and out of the restaurant business for many years, mm-hmm. which is how I ultimately landed there. And my mom has done a number of things as well. She used to have her own store in Rhode Island, where she sold sort of a myriad of things. And when we moved to New York, she worked for the Cooper Hewitt Museum for many years, spearheading their gift shop. Mm-hmm. And now she's a rare book dealer.
Interesting.
Yeah, and my dad is involved in the restaurants with me.
Right.
So,
right. So both entrepreneurial. So there's some DNA there for wanting to have your own restaurants.
Yes, I think there's some DNA there for beating to your own drum, and yes, entrepreneurial.
Risk-taking.
I think so.
You take a lot of risks in your... You take more risks than most people in your food, and that's kind of interesting, but we'll evolve there.
Yeah, again, yeah. I think my parents are very free thinkers and encourage that. Yeah. They're very creative people as well and encourage that. And I think that those two things are sort of... In a very broad sense, like curiosity and hopefully some baseline creativity is helping us or allowing, you know, part of why we are where we are at the restaurants.
Right. So what did you enjoy your years at college?
Yes, very much so. I enjoyed my years at college. I made some of the best friends I have to this day are the group of people that I met in college and still stay in touch with. Those were wonderful years. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you think college formed you? What do you think? How did you grow in those years?
Well, again, I think it's part of, you know, leaving the flock, leaving the fold, going out, you know, just being independent as much as you possibly can, figuring things out on your own, trying not to, you know, call home with too many questions, but just sort of. Sorting your way through the problems, as well as obviously a continuing academic education, and for me working as well. I held a job the whole time I was in college.
Really? What'd you do?
I worked in food service the whole 4 years I was in college.
How were you drawn to that?
Drawn to
food service.
I'd been working in kitchens and food service since I was 11, so jobs were almost always involved. And some type of food service.
So tell me about the 11-year-old job.
I was peeling potatoes at the Olympia Tea Room in Watch Hill, Rhode Island.
And why?
Because summers were spent with my father, because, again, my parents were divorced, and I spent summers were with Dad, and that meant having some sort of a job. I think my parents were believers in me working... on some level, and not necessarily, I mean, peeling potatoes for whatever it was, $1 or $5 a bucket, it wasn't grueling, but it was still, I think, a valuable life lesson.
Was that your father's restaurant?
No, my father owned restaurants, but they were closed by the time, you know, before I could really, I mean, I have the faintest of memories, but I think all of his restaurants, at one point, I think he had three, and they were all closed by the time I was four or five.
So what was your mindset at 11? Did you do it for the money? Did you like that atmosphere?
Again, it was an opportunity to see my father. You know, again, I looked forward to seeing my time with mom because that meant seeing mom. I looked forward to time with dad because that meant seeing dad, obviously. And when you spend sort of half of a year with one and half with the other, you begin to anticipate when it's time to swap. I never dreaded it. You know, it was always a nice time. And it just, you know, my father was involved in food service, and I also liked having money in my pocket, and it was nice. I don't know. It just always felt good. It felt honest. I've always believed in, you know, physical labor, working with my hands. I had a very brief stint within an office job, and it didn't work for me because I just I didn't relate to it. But you know, I always worked in the kitchen, but I never thought that's where I would be heading. I was in the moment. And it wasn't until much later in life that I realized I was heading that way all along.
You think you could be an academic?
No, I don't think I'm smart enough to be an academic. No.
Because, you know, what you've studied are kind of intellectual things. And to say, you know, an office job, or could you be a writer?
I'm certainly not good enough to be a writer. No, I don't think I could be a writer.
No.
I like the physical aspect of work.
You do?
Yeah, I also like the mental aspect. I like the creative aspect. I don't know. I have a profound respect for teachers, for academics. But I don't think I'm...
And you couldn't...
I don't think...
Just because philosophy is such an interesting choice of major. And then to say, I don't want a job that's in a... office or something like that. It's kind of an interesting...
Yeah, I mean, most people that are philosophy majors go on to become teachers and things like that.
Right.
So it's maybe not your standard...
No, but yeah, it's path.
Path for,
yeah.
For a chef, but, you know, it doesn't seem that odd to me, and I'm pleased with the results thus far. But
it's a very interesting mosaic how you get there. We're going to take a break right here, and we'll be back in a moment.
Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. We support Heritage Radio Network because all you folks listening are so genuine, so dedicated to serious food, so much a part of what this country needs to strive to become. People like you are few and far between, and it's obvious to us at Fairway that we've got to stick together. Our desire is that the word gets out about Heritage Radio Network in its support for serious food, foodstuffs that offer memorability and timelessness, authenticity and rarefied quality. This country grew too fast to have established any degree of a heritage. Europe had centuries to develop one. America has not. Heritage Radio Network serves to hasten the evolution of a society that often appears coarse and uninterested. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, sitting today talking to Wiley Dufresne of WD50 and Alder Restaurants in New York City. And we've just gotten to the point where... So right after college, what did you do?
I came here.
Oh, you came right after college?
Yeah, I think it was about 3 months after college came here.
And so...
I graduated in January of 93, I'm pretty sure. Uh-huh. And so was it a 6 month program?
Yeah.
So then I came.
So what made you want to study cooking professionally and do the, you know, culinary technique type course? Did you say I want to be a chef?
Well, it was the summer before my senior year of college, which is the time in your life when you're supposed to decide what it is you want to be in this world, because you're about to finish college and you're supposed to go out and make something of yourself. And that was the first restaurant job I ever had in a legitimate kitchen, in a real kitchen, and that moved me in the way I if I had had my druthers, I would have been a professional athlete. But I don't...
Oh, there it is. I was looking for what that
But I don't possess was. Any sort of special innate physical attributes. I'm not taller, faster, stronger, or any of those things than the average American male. In fact, I am the average height of the American male. So that was never in the cards. But working in a kitchen, working in that particular kitchen that summer was the first time I was in a real sort of serious restaurant brigade. And see, and I was, it was there that I was having the same sensations, the same joy that I found in playing sports. And that's when I said, you know what, I've never done anything that I've enjoyed as much as playing sports until this moment. So now I'm going to give it a try. But I should finish my college career, because that would, I think, be very disappointing to my parents. I mean, my final year of college was not my most enthusiastic year, because it didn't seem like where I was doing it because out of obligation. And I, again, some of the best friends I've ever had, and I didn't want to leave them, but I knew that my academic direction was not where I was going to go after that.
So in that kitchen where you said, I like this as much as sports, what aspect of it appealed to you?
Well, I would say that many of the life lessons that can be found in sports, in team sports in particular, of which I am a believer, again, mostly because I never excelled at individual sports enough to play them very often. I would say that team sports and life in a restaurant can offer you almost the identical life lessons. Mm-hmm. So at that time, it was all the physical stuff, you know. You start your day prepping in a kitchen much like you practice in
warm-ups.
Yeah, you at nighttime you have dinner service much like you have the big game. You have the stratification. You have the coach. You have the captain. You have the star players. You have the prep. You know the bench players. You have it's very similar, and you have the same physical sensations. You wake up with a soreness, with an achy back. You have the anxiety, you have the stress, but you also have the opportunity for redemption. It's very redemptive. You have the opportunity to, you know, I missed a layup or I struck out, but I'm going to get up again. I overcooked a piece of fish, or I screwed this up, but I'm going to have to do it over and over again. And you have to sort of pick yourself up and move on. And there were all these just amazing parallels. And the more I've done it, the more I've realized that sports, team sports, are almost identical in all of the beautiful things they can find. I mean, back then for me, you know, I wanted to be, when I got started after I graduated here, I wanted to be the star player. I wanted to make the winning layup. I wanted to be the guy that was like, chef, give me more. How many more fish do you want? I can go faster. And now my role has changed. I don't need to be the star player, but I still want to make sure my team wins the game.
So what was the first job you had when you graduated school? Do you remember?
Yeah, I was going to school here during the day, and I was working at the Gotham Bar and Grill at night.
You work with Alfred?
Second school ended, I had to leave here and run to the Gotham and work. So I would work. I worked at the pastry station at the Gotham. So I would. School ended around 1.
3.
I felt like it ended earlier.
No,
but
it went from 9 to 3. Because you had to do restaurant service in Lake Hull.
Right.
So we never finished before 3.
And then I literally would sprint.
How
to
long
the Gotham.
Were you here before you? How many months? Because this is only a 6-month course. How many months did you go to school and work at the same time?
The whole time I was in school, I worked.
So from the first weeks that yep. you went in. So then did you go knock on Alfred's door, or how did I
get the job with Alfred?
Yeah.
Actually, my cousin, Alfred, and my cousin. Had a house next to each other in the Hamptons.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom, being a good mom, asked her cousin if he would ask Alfred if he could give me a job.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met with Alfred while I was, you know, still a student here.
You must have been exhausted.
You know, at that point, I loved it. I would, you know, I'd get home at, I don't know, 1:32 in the morning. And at that, when I first started, I was living with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
In Union Square, trying to save up some money
mm-hmm.
to get an apartment. So I spent the better part of the school year living at home to save money. Mm-hmm. I would go to City Bakery back when Maury was on
17th Street.
I would go there in the morning. I would have a croissant. I would go over my, you know, my work for the coursework. I would come here. I would do my thing. I would sprint over there. And I would, if, you know, I look back on it now, it was crazy. If there was less than 160 covers on the books, I think it was 160 or 260. I don't even remember. I had to work the pastry station all by myself. And here I was. I had no idea what I was doing, you know. But most of the production was done by the pastry chef and other people, mm-hmm. and I just was simply assembling things and putting them out. But it was a terrifying experience mm-hmm. to be all, ostensibly all alone. But it was a great experience. I learned a lot. It was
all
wonderful.
Alone at one of the top chefs, restaurants in the city.
Eventually,
doing,
yeah.
Doing the, wow, good
or
for
I would
you.
Be with one other person. But I was it was crazy. And right. I get home 1:30, 2 o'clock. And back then, I mean, I loved it. I don't remember being exhausted.
You're young. Right?
Yes.
Right. So then how long after you graduated here, did you stay at Gotham?
I worked for 13 months for Alfred. That was split between Gotham, and back then he opened 1/5. You remember, which
yes.
is now where Oto is?
Yes.
And when he opened Oto, I was on the... I mean, when he opened 1/5, I was on the opening team of 1/5. But okay. I spent about 13, 14 months there. I had a nagging injury, a ski injury from college that required surgery, so I had to eventually get my knee operated on.
Ooh. So
I had to quit.
Do you read a lot of books or
during that time? Yeah. Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think the recovery time now would be weeks versus then it was months. It took me 6 months.
Ooh.
But yeah, I spent a lot of time sitting on my couch reading cookbooks.
Huh.
Yeah.
So then where'd you go next?
First
of all, what did you take away from that Gotham experience? Where did the layers of chef, you know, what layers started coming on in those days?
Well, I was just so green, you know. I was so green. I knew so little. I mean, Alfred said to me, I think I actually started working for Alfred before the class started. Because Alfred said to me, look, I'll give you a job, but you have to... You have to make sure you get all your mise en place done every day. I said, no problem. I said, no problem, chef. And I got
so you were working so then I got, before you came to school.
Yeah, because I got home and I said to myself, what does mise en place mean? I have no idea, but I didn't want to tell him that I didn't know what mise en place was. I just said, I'll do it, whatever it is. So then I went home and I looked up mise en place. I said, okay, I got to get my prep done. Okay, I get it. But I didn't want to say, what is mise en place? Because I figured I don't want to betray that I know nothing.
Right.
But it was obvious. It had to be obvious that I knew
right.
nothing.
Yeah.
But I started school shortly after and I realized what mise en place was and went forward. But after Gotham...
You didn't feel like you could have just blown off school and just done Gotham?
You know, what I liked about the program here was that it was going to give me some very basic skills and a vocabulary that I didn't have. And obviously, it's painfully clear when... The most basic kitchen term was completely unknown to me at the time. So I liked the fact that it was giving me a basic working vocabulary and a sense that, you know,
foundation.
A foundation.
Yeah.
It gave me
that's
a good foundation.
That's what it should do.
And it was, I very much enjoyed my time here and it was very useful. It was, to use a philosophical term, very utilitarian for me. So
that's what we aim to do. But anyway, getting back, when did you go to Jean-Georges?
So after my surgery, I had about 6 months off, and I needed, when it was done, I eventually run out of money, so I sold my Wendy's stock that I had.
Yeah, Wendy's stock. Was that your pick?
No, my grandfather had given that to me.
Keeping it in the food spectrum.
I wish I didn't have to sell it, but I had to sell it because I ran out of money.
Right.
And then I went... to go work at the U.S. Open out in Flushing for 2 weeks. And that was great. That was 2 weeks straight.
Is that Restaurant Associates?
I think at that point, yeah. I think it was Restaurant Associates.
Something like that.
Yeah. But that was great. I mean, to me, it was like combat pay. I think it was like $17, $18, $19 an hour. And it was 2 weeks straight with no day off. And I had to go to work. I had to be there by 11 p.m.
Yeah.
And I worked till 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. So I worked on the overnight. And it was again no time off, but I had a pass, so I could go to any tennis match.
Oh, and you love sports.
So as soon as I was done, I'd either get to work early and watch the end of a match. I couldn't sit, but I could walk anywhere.
Yeah.
In any stadium.
Wow.
Or at the end of the night or the beginning of the morning before I went home, I could go watch them practice, which was fun. The best part of that job, though, was we'd take a break at like 2:30 in the morning. And I would go to center court all by myself. I had a pass to go anywhere. And I would go to center court and lie on the ground in the middle of center court and just look up at the sky all by myself. It was incredible. I don't know why they let me do it. But I had an all-access pass everywhere. You know, security would... I'm allowed to be here. And I'd just go to center court and stare up at the sky. It was so cool.
That is cool.
It was amazing. That was the best part of the job. And then at the time, when it was all over, they just gave me this gigantic check. I think it... $2,000, $2,500, but that covered the next 2 or 3 months' rent for me. So I thought, wow, this is great.
That goes in the memoir.
But while I was doing that, I was assembling a list of 5 restaurants that I wanted to work at. And I had read Simple Cuisine, I had gone to dinner at JoJo's, and I had decided that one of the 5 was John George. And
was it about Jean Georges that appealed? Because by this time you're pretty sophisticated, having worked at Gotham, you had a lot of time to think about it. What aspects of Jean Georges appealed to you?
Because here was a chef who was doing something different, who was being creative, who was taking French food, which I was totally 150% on board with and ingrained in and educated in and believed in, and he was finding a way to make it his own. He was finding a way to walk it down the road. He was finding a way to do something, take it, and work within it, but change it. You know, he was removing the butter and the cream and the heavy stocks. He was introducing juices and vinegars and flavored oils. And I just thought, this is amazing. Like, he's making a difference. He's doing something. He's leaving the industry a better place than he found it. And that's all I had ever wanted to do. And so... I went there, and of the 5 places I dropped my resume off, that was the one that resonated with me the most, and I wanted to work at so badly.
Dare we ask the other 4?
You can ask, but I don't remember all of them. It was Boulay. It was David Burke at Park Avenue at that point. It was JoJo's, and I can't for the life of me remember the other 2. Yeah. Somewhere in a box, I believe the list.
Right. And well, then, when you do the memoir, you'll have
and
to
a,
find.
You know, as a gat and a street map and all the things, but. But I just wanted to work there so badly. I did my trail, and I called, and I called, and I called, and I called. And I think I was so annoying that they finally said, just stop calling us. You've got a job.
So that was JoJo?
That was JoJo's.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And then when you got there, what position did they put you in?
Well, it was interesting. There was I started at the same time as another guy, and we were both garmager/pastry. But I really wanted to work garmager. I just finished working pastry, and I just wanted to move up. So I kind of wrangled myself and sort of elbowed myself and muscled myself and was like, I'm going to work garmager. And he worked. We ended up becoming really good friends and sharing the duties, but I sort of insisted as best I could, as someone who had no business insisting, that I work in garmager. And that's what I did. I ended up working every station in the restaurant.
What'd you learn?
I learned a lot. I mean, I learned, I still think that to this day, the biggest imprint, aside from my parents, on my food and my approach to cooking and my thought process is John George. Simplicity, you know, simplicity, taking away. The idea that the more things you put on the plate, the easier it is to hide. The more best food is 3-4 elements, and that's it. 3 or 4 elements, and that's it. Simplicity, and to appreciate acidity, you know, the value of acid on a plate, how acidity can really right the ship.
Mm. So you stayed with him for years, right?
I stayed with John George for 5.5, 6 years, yeah.
Do you think someone needs to stay with a, and I'm going to just say master chef, because that's what Jean George is in what you learn there. It's like working in the studio of a great painter in Florence, you know. How long does it take to kind of absorb a chef?
Well, I asked Alain that. I asked
Alain Sayac?
I asked Sayac that when I was here. I said, how long should I work for somebody? And as he often does, you know, sort of talks in riddles and non-committal answers. He said, "You should stay probably 2 to 3 years, but you should stay until you stop learning," which, of course, you don't ever stop learning. Mm. But he made it clear that it should be at least a couple of years, if not 3 years. And I think that that's something that a lot of young people don't to this day. People jump around a lot. People get anxious. But I think there's an incredible... you also have to find someone that you click with. And I clicked there. I clicked immediately. And, you know, in hindsight, I probably could have stayed forever.
Really?
I think so, sure, because...
He's always opening...
Well, look at what he's done. I mean, look what he was constantly providing me with opportunity. I stayed as long as I did because I felt like I was continually being given the opportunity to learn a new skill. Mm. And so, once I became the chef of Prime in Las Vegas doing 450 covers a night, it wasn't to say that was it, that I was done, because, again, someone with their eyes open realizes that this is a never-ending opportunity for education.
How do you learn in the kitchen when you're in the kitchen like that? You're saying I could still be with him and you'd still be learning. How do you learn? 6 years after the kitchen, your skills are kind of rote in some ways. What are you learning? Is it visceral? Does it just absorb? What are you learning?
Well, you know, what we strive to do at WD50 and Alder is build on the education that we started at, you know, places like here at the
International Culinary
the FCI.
The FCI. You can always say FCI.
It's the FCI for me forever.
Yes, forever. I know.
Yeah. We learned how to cook here, and we learned how to cook working for some of those chefs. But there's not only a how, but there's a why. And I wanted to discover and build on that. I wanted to learn why I was doing things, you know. Mm. Teach you how to roast a chicken. You know, you learn one way to roast a chicken here. You learn another way from Jean-Georges, another way from Alfred, another way from this person or that person. But at a point, there's an interesting aspect to a culinary education where you learn how to cook, but you don't necessarily learn why you're doing it. And some of those answers are incomplete. And, well, why do we do it like this? Well, because we get the results we're looking for, or because we've always done it that way, or because it works. Or sort of the least useful answer is because I told you to do it that way. That's more of an old-school European answer. Well, I said do it this way, which I think for a young cook is very useful. But as you get older, you need to learn more. I want to know what was happening to that chicken as it was roasting. What's literally happening? Well, I don't understand what roasting a chicken means. I understand you put it in an oven, 350 degrees, 375, on the one leg for 15 minutes, on the other leg, and then maybe the breast up, and after 45 minutes, you let it rest for 20 more, and it's beautiful and it's moist. But I haven't understood on a deeper level what's happening to the bird. The skin, the muscles, they're contracting. What does cooking even mean? And maybe that's the philosophical person in me that wanted a deeper level of understanding, and so that's what I've pursued, that's what we've continued to look for, and that's what we've tried to understand, and that's where a lot of the scientific sort of explanations come in as to what's happening. What does it mean to say something's cooking, and how do you understand that definition, and then once you take that knowledge, then you can apply your creativity and do some really interesting things. So that's what I mean when I say there's sort of an endless opportunity to learn in a kitchen. We're never going to have all the answers. We're never going to understand everything about what's going on while we cook. And, you know, it's great because people like myself and chefs all over the world had started asking these questions 15, 20, 25 years ago. And then there began coursework, you know, people like McGee and Dave Arnold, et cetera. And there began to be this opportunity, but for a long time, some of the answers weren't available, or they were hard to find. And I'm interested in learning as much as I can about what I do, because there'll never really be a right or a wrong way to roast a chicken, but there will be a more or a less informed way to roast that chicken. So I want to understand all the variables so I can make the best decisions on how I believe a chicken could be roasted, or an egg poached, or a fish cooked, or a green bean green, or, you know, make sure that my béarnaise sauce doesn't separate and my mashed potatoes aren't gooey. But so I'm in it for the long haul, because that's great. I'll never know all the answers, but I'll just sort of chip away at. There's an underlying ignorance in a way, which is interesting, but there's also an ability to make beautiful, wonderful food. I just want to understand a little bit. I want to understand not only how, but why.
Okay, we're going to take a break right here. We're going to come back. I'm going to really delve into that. You're listening to Chef Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Wiley Dufresne of WD50 in Alder Restaurants. And I think you're one of the top two, three handful chefs that is at the pinnacle of modernist cuisine. Meaning, let's piggyback on that. Why things happen and delving into the science behind the food to do other things or to explore the food more fully. How do you, you know, not to your customers, but when you, you know, when you go to a family reunion and they kind of know you're a chef and somebody comes up and says, well, what kind of food do you do? I don't want you to take the easy thing and say, I just do food. I mean, if you meet somebody who you really respect and they say, what do you do and what kind of food do? How do you give them a respectful answer to giving them an insight to what kind of food you
do? It's very hard. It's very difficult to give them the answer that they want. So I say we make modern food, modern American food, contemporary American food. I don't really care what you call it. But that's what we're doing. We're using all of the information that I learned here, and all the information I learned from the great chefs I worked for, all of the information from today going backwards, as well as hopefully information from tomorrow going forwards. We're trying to avail ourselves to all the information, all the technology, all the equipment, all the information that's available. And there's a lot of information. And people have known for a long time, people that aren't chefs have known for a long time what's happening to food as you do all these things to it. And so I want to access that information. I want to tap into it so that, you know, Clarence Birdseye knew more about frozen food in 1919 than you and I do today. So if we can learn what he did and learn what he understand his understanding of freezing food, not because I want to freeze a lot of food, but because there are frozen things in restaurants. The best kitchens in the world freeze things, when I can just do it better. And so I want to tap into all that stuff. But when people ask what kind of food we make, I say we make modern American food, contemporary American food. We make, it's tasty food that it's hard to explain. I try to.
Okay, so I'm Dorothy Hamilton. Chef, owner of my restaurants, Dorothy's Place, and I do contemporary American food. And I love farms and freshness. And so it's April, it's spring. And I would say, I'm doing my menu. I'm going to have a lovely, you know, lamb chop from, you know, sourced from this farm. I'm going to start with a beautiful creamless but pea soup that's incredibly intense. And I've got some techniques to do that. But a very classic pea soup. Nice lamb chop grilled. Maybe some kind of potato gratin. A special cheese that makes it my own. And a rhubarb compote with a special creme with it. Okay,
sounds
contemporary.
Delicious.
It is delicious. I don't think I'd ever find that in your restaurant. So what? It's April. How do you conceive a dish that would include those kind of ingredients, or with the enthusiasm or the perspective that I'm bringing to that? How does it?
Well, I'm buying all of those ingredients in the same place you are.
Okay.
I'm not shopping anywhere that you aren't, and you're not shopping anywhere that I'm not.
Okay.
You know?
So how do you conceive?
All great chefs are buying their stuff in the same places.
Place. Right.
You know, that should be implicit in my mind. It shouldn't. Right. I don't know that I necessarily agree with the notion of standing up on my soapbox and talking about the great ingredients I'm using, because I think that should be implicit, that any chef worth his or her weight is sourcing responsibly. Like that's not a reason I want to go to a restaurant, because they're claiming they're using great ingredients. Mm. Because who's claiming they're not using great ingredients?
True.
Who's saying, you know, well, we're using crappy ingredients and doing really cool stuff with it? No, everyone wants the best ingredients. Mm. That's not, to me, necessarily a talking point. Mm. You know, I'm curious to know where you're getting yours. Yeah. As a chef, because you might know a farm that I don't, or you might have a connection. But I don't think that's a reason that I should that's a hook I should throw out to my customer base. Like, come here because we're using good stuff,
yeah.
Versus Bob next door who's not. But we're taking it. We're trying to honor it and be respectful of it in the same way you are. But we're trying to just have a little bit of fun with it. We're trying to do something maybe a little different. We're trying to incorporate our locale, our geography, our personal history, some humor, and some fun into it. And again, I'm not so sure that what you're doing is necessarily modern. I don't know what the definition of modern. You know, you're talking about what you're doing, and that sounds lovely and it sounds delicious, but I don't know. Is it modern?
No, it's not. No.
But you just said you were
all right,
modern.
So was it okay. Well, so how do you define modern? Do you have to use a different technique? Does it have to be a new type of preparation? Or?
I mean,
a lot of people think modern is finding a new spice from Vietnam and putting it on there because it's modern here because nobody here ever had it before.
Correct.
But that's not necessarily modern.
No, and I'm not so hung up on all these titles either. Yeah. It's more the press, people that need to categorize things and put things in a box. I just think, you know, is the food good or not? And I think that the food is good. And I hope the food is good. And I don't mind if... I don't really mind what you call it. You know, I think that whole molecular thing is a terrible name because it doesn't suit anybody's purposes, really. But
can I take one of your dishes? It's kind of the one I use when people tell me they don't like molecular gastronomy. And this isn't molecular, but it just shows, I don't know if you did this for fun, because I thought it was more than fun. It really changed, it gave me an insight to not just your food, but why we should be pushing the envelope on technique and it was, it's that, you know, your iconic oysters and where you take the oysters and you put them, I think, in a bread or a rectangular pan, and you put in transcontaminate the glue and you freeze it.
We just pound it old-fashioned way with a meat tenderizer between two sheets of plastic.
No meat glue.
Nothing.
No, okay.
Meat glue doesn't work on oysters.
But you freeze it.
We freeze it.
And don't you have to... Didn't you shave it on a... because it's very thinly...
Because we just pounded it thinly between two sheets of plastic.
Ah.
And then we froze it so we could cut it, so we could portion it.
Okay.
And then while it was still frozen, we would put it on a plate and then let it defrost on the plate, because it defrosted almost instantly.
Right. So it was Judith Jones I was talking to, actually. And she said, I don't want to have anything to do with that kind of food. And I said, well, let me describe this dish to you, because you order oysters, and everyone knows what an oyster looks like, and you have a concept, and it's absolutely wonderful. You put it in your mouth, and you have the sea with the liquid. But an oyster is as much about texture as it is about taste in a lot of ways when you order it. And when you brought that such thin, I compared it to a communion host. That was the thickness of it. And it was similar to a communion host when I put it in my mouth. It was frozen. So, you know, you like oysters to be very cold. They come on ice. But it melted on my tongue. And it had all the essence of the sea. And I didn't have to chew it. And I didn't have to deal with the texture of it. And quite frankly, I don't like the texture of an oyster. And I thought, this is... And I love oysters. And I love that sea and that brine. And I thought, this is brilliant. This is absolutely brilliant. because it's taken the oyster and it's given it its total respect to the oyster and taken the essence of the oyster, and it just delivered a different way to experience it in you know, the not having the chewiness. And in fact, I think it brought out the flavors much more strongly, because you weren't thinking about the texture of it. You really just got to enjoy the whole flavor. And when I explained that to Judith, she said, "I think I'd like to try."
Well, that's the idea. We're not ultimately trying to change whatever your platonic oyster memory is. We're not trying to take away from that. I mean, we served it with pistachios and apples and black olives, which are not radical flavors, I don't think. And even for an oyster are not necessarily radical. But pistachios and apples and olives, one could argue, are old friends and have been together for a long time. And the idea of bringing those sort of fruits in a way together with the oyster is not a radical idea. And what we did was we would take those oysters, beautiful oysters, we'd marinate them in oil and vinegar for 5 minutes and then drain them. Again, oysters typically see a vinegar, a mignonette, something like that. And then we'd pound them and just pile a little tower of those other ingredients on the oyster. We're not trying to change what the oyster means to you. I want you to close your eyes and still eat it and say, this is still giving me the joy that an oyster can give me. But you're just encountering it in a different way. The way, if you come to WD50 tonight, we'll still serve you an oyster. But now what we do is we serve you an edible oyster shell. We serve it with a shell that you can eat. And all we've done is taken an edible clay and mixed it with a little bit of sugar and some fat and a tiny bit of squid ink and made this paste. And we've painted it inside of Madeleine molds, which we've then baked in the oven, and the clay hardens. You pop them out, and it looks just like the shell of an oyster. And you have it next to an oyster with some green beans and a little bit of shallots. And it's not meant to change what an oyster means to you, but it's meant to give you a little bit of a smile, have a little bit of fun, because now suddenly you're not only eating the oyster, but you're eating the part that you've never been allowed to eat, the shell. And it's just supposed to give you a little bit of a wink and a little bit of a smile. And that's all we've ever wanted to do, is have a little bit of fun along the way. Change the way you interact with it a little bit, but not take away from the essential nature of the ingredient. We're trying to honor those ingredients as much as anybody else. As much as anybody else.
All right. So by doing that, you're not just doing something. You're taking one of the maybe greatest gastronomic delicacies, an oyster. And you're saying, let's have fun with it or improve on it. And so you've played with the shell and things like that. And sometimes that can work. And I'm sure sometimes it can't. It doesn't. And so what I'm trying to get to here is that as a chef, you could play it safe and just serve an oyster, a beautifully sourced, fresh oyster, nice and cold. But you take risks. You're having fun. You're intellectually stimulating yourself and your customers. But there's huge risk involved, and not, you know, maybe the customer won't come back. Economic risk aside, there's just huge risk involved, and not. I don't think many chefs are drawn to that. Do you see it as risk, or do you just see it? I'm having fun, and people who like what I do are going to come here and get it, understand me. They get my jokes.
I can't see any other way to do it. I have great respect for someone who works in a bistro and is making a beautiful roast chicken, a bright green haricot vert, and delicious mashed potatoes and a béarnaise sauce. And I think that that's an important skill set that every cook should have. But for me, on a day in and day out basis, it wouldn't be expressing a certain part of myself in a way that feels important or feels necessary. I can't always explain why you have to do that, but I enjoy doing it. I also enjoy preparing roast chicken, mashed potatoes, and haricot vert. Like I would cook much more simply for myself. But in terms of what I do as my career, what I do to sort of feed my head, feed my brain, and my heart and soul and all that is I like that process. And I like creating an environment where other people can also think creatively and ask those questions of themselves.
Is this the team that works in your kitchen?
At both kitchens, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But again, it has to taste good. Forget about all that other stuff. It has to taste good. And when you say that the oyster tasted good, that's all I want. I want you to understand that I'm not trying to deliver you. I may be trying to screw around with the way you see Eggs Benedict, but I don't want to mess up what Eggs Benedict means to you, what oysters mean to you, what these things mean to you. I don't want to take away from the childhood memories or the value that those things can do to a dining experience. I just want to maybe get you to smile along the way, have a little bit of fun. You know, if we give you everything bagel ice cream and it comes out and we made bagel base that tastes, because we just took lots of everything bagels and toasted them and threw them into a neutral ice cream base, and then we made ice cream out of it and put it in tiny Savarin molds and popped them out and airbrushed them with sprinkled poppy seeds and sesame seeds on them and scent I ever had, and then suddenly you realize it's ice cream. You're going to smile. But it still has to taste of an everything bagel. And it's served with some smoked salmon, some pickled red onions, and some cream cheese. But the cream cheese is crispy, and the salmon is, like, fluffy and light. And so all of these things are just ways you haven't normally encountered them before. But when they go into your mouth, they bring you right back to whatever a bagel with cream cheese and lox means to you. Mm. And so hopefully it's delicious and fun and playful. And why not, for that matter? Because there was a time when that roast lamb with the spring pea soup or whatever you're talking about was radical as well. So I don't know why we pick a random time and say we should go back to that, because that time was radical at one point. And we could go there and say, well, we should go back to the... Should we go back to throwing sticks at our food and holding it over an open flame? Because even that was radical at one point. So we're just moving down the road. I think it's the natural sort of evolution of things.
Do you have any challenges right now? I know you just...
I have two children. I have lots of challenges.
Oh, that's joy. That's joy,
yeah,
too.
Of course. I'm just kidding. I mean, absolutely. Restaurants are filled with challenges.
Yes. There's the business of restaurant. I know you opened Alder, but and as a more casual, maybe more affordable place. Is there any... aside from the challenge of running a business, I think what you're doing with food is so interesting and unique, because you do it well, and it's not gimmicky. I never feel your food is gimmicky.
We've made some mistakes along the way.
How important is it? We're talking to young chefs out there. How important is it to make mistakes, and what should you learn from it?
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting word. How important is it to make mistakes? It's not something you can avoid. So I don't know if that's the right word. I mean, there's a lot to be learned from mistakes, because everyone will make a mistake no matter what. Everyone will make a mistake. What I tell my cooks is don't get hung up on your mistake. It's what you do after the mistake that will separate you from the guy next to you, the cook next to you. What do you do? You've made a mistake. Now what? How do we move on? That's making the mistake is not the problem. It's what you do after the mistake that will separate you or help define who you are. And making different mistakes, making new mistakes, not making the same mistake over and over again, is much more important. Don't get hung up on a mistake, because I don't care who they are, every chef makes a mistake. And if they tell you that they don't make mistakes, I say that they're lying, because we all make mistakes. We're human beings, we're essentially flawed. We make mistakes. But you can't get stuck on them. Again, that's part of the whole sports thing. You missed a layup. You struck out. It's okay. What do you do now? Now what?
So what are your challenges right now?
It's a constant challenge. There's the day-to-day of operating a business challenges, but there's the creative challenges. There's making sure that you're inspiring your team still, that you're leading them, that that's important to constantly be doing things and showing up and making sure that they're inspired by you and that you're helping them achieve their goals. Like I said, I don't need to be the guy that can butcher the fish the fastest or cook the meat the quickest or anything like that. I need to come in and help them understand what they're doing, show them how they can do things better, how they can work better, how they can be more efficient, how they can not get overwhelmed at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night when all the tickets are coming in. You know, restaurant years are like dog years. You know, you don't see, I mean, this is what, 22 years for me, something like that? 21 years for me, I've been a professional cook. No, very few athletes are actually still playing their sport after that many years, but hundreds of athletes, thousands of athletes are still involved in their sport and are still contributing and helping, mentoring, teaching, learning. And that's what I want to do, is help the people below me. I can't stand on the line in the heat anymore. I'm falling apart, you know, physically. But that's okay. I still love being there. I still feel like I have a lot to contribute. I still feel like that on a busy Saturday night at 9 o'clock, I want to be there to help us get, you know, to the end of the road.
You ever think 10 years out?
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think about?
It took me a long time to open a second restaurant. Mm-hmm. It took me 10 years to open a second restaurant. I don't want to wait another 10 years before I do another one.
Why do you want to do another one?
Because I have some more ideas in my head that I think are decent ideas that I'd like to see happen. For the longest time, all I wanted to do was make WD-50 the best restaurant I could possibly make it, and I still do want to do that. But I also now, because I have a team in place and I have a system, feel like I can step away a little bit and begin to explore other ideas. It took me a long time to get there, longer than most, as you can see, since there are people on the wall who started after me and have a lot more than me.
But we all have our own pace.
That's probably...
And we all have our own sense of fulfillment. So, you know, I don't see people having other restaurants or other careers necessarily being ahead of you where on this continuum.
No, I'm quite happy with the way life has gone. I'm not complaining at all. No. I just have made a decision that I don't want to wait another 10. Yeah. I can't open one restaurant every 10 years because I'm getting old.
Right. Well, I'm getting older. Well, we've really gone the limit here. I don't think the producers over at Heritage will let us talk anymore. But it's been great talking to you.
Thank you. It's
really
been great
long
to be
overdue.
Here.
Thanks for coming by today. And thanks to Robin Cohen and our producers at Heritage. And we'll see you next time.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.